Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Shock Values, Prices and Inflation in American Democracy by Carola Binder. Narrated by Ann Richardson. Introduction. Of the People, by the People, for the People. Price Control. Office of Price Administration, Historical Reports on War Administration. Price Stabilization in American Democracy. In 2021, inflation in the United States exceeded 5% for the first time in decades. From there, it continued to climb. Like most economists, I carefully tracked this ascent, eagerly poring through the inflation reports that came out each month. I earned a PhD in economics in 2015. For my entire career, policymakers and scholars had been concerned about inflation that was too low rather than too high. Almost overnight, the situation had dramatically reversed. The United States had not experienced such high inflation since the Great Inflation of the 1970s and early 1980s. Back then, neither President Richard Nixon's price and wage controls nor President Gerald Ford's notorious red "Whip Inflation Now" buttons stopped wages and prices from spiraling upward. The Great Inflation ended only when Federal Reserve Chairman Paul Volcker finally committed to and followed through with a program of severe monetary tightening. This so-called Volcker disinflation was a painful process involving a long recession, high interest rates, and high unemployment. But it also demonstrated the power of monetary policy for stabilizing prices and pointed to a solution to the problem of recurrent inflation. Delegate price stability to the central bank and give the central bank independence in the pursuit of this goal. Following the Volcker disinflation, the practice of raising interest rates in the face of inflation became consensus among academic economists around the world, and the academic consensus became the political reality. Central banks were granted substantial political independence to facilitate their pursuit of price stability. Many central banks announced explicit numerical targets for inflation in the 1990s and 2000s. In the United States, the Federal Reserve kept inflation low and relatively stable for years, but it waited until 2012 to explicitly announce its own 2% inflation target. Its preferred measure of inflation, the annual change in the personal consumption expenditures, PCE, price index, averaged 2.1% from 1985 to 2020. The return of inflation in 2021, in a time after central bank economists had seemingly solved the riddle of price control and produced decades of price stability, shook the economics profession hard. But the return of inflation was not only, or even primarily, an academic concern. It was even more a social and a political one. The impacts of inflation are widespread, and its causes are difficult to understand. Rising prices affect every member of society and can be especially devastating to families struggling to afford groceries, gas, and other necessities. Unsurprisingly, people suffering the ill effects of inflation are loath to leave it in the hands of central bankers. They want their elected officials to do something to slow the pace of price increases, preferably without Volcker-style rate hikes and rising unemployment. But what can be done? In January 2022, The Washington Post asked a dozen economists for ideas to combat inflation. One of them, Todd Tucker of the Roosevelt Institute, proposed using price controls. "The time is now," he wrote, "to begin destigmatizing greater democratic control over price levels." Tucker's characterization of price controls as democratic echoed the logic of his think tank's namesake, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, whose administration implemented an extensive system of price controls and rationing during World War II. This system, Roosevelt argued, was the only democratic, equitable solution for the wartime economy, as those who can afford to pay more for commodity should not be privileged over those who cannot. Pamphlets of Roosevelt's Office of Price Administration proclaimed, "Of the people, by the people, for the people, price control." Tucker was not alone in calling for price controls. For example, in The Guardian, the economist Isabella Weber compared the inflation situation of 2021 to World War II, suggesting that the government could target the specific prices that drive inflation instead of moving to austerity, which risks a recession. Price controls, which had seemed relegated to history after the Volcker disinflation, were back on the table. It is worth emphasizing the difference between price controls and the current approach of allowing the Federal Reserve to control prices. The Fed's 2% inflation target is a target for aggregate inflation, the rate of change of an official measure of the overall price level. The Fed does not target the prices of specific goods or services. Thus, the relative prices of different products can vary freely, depending on supply and demand conditions. Price controls, in contrast, impose restrictions on particular prices and prevent relative prices from fluctuating freely. They thus disrupt the powerful informational and coordinating role of prices in a market economy. The effects of such disruption, of course, depend heavily on circumstances. As I am writing this book, it seems unlikely that anything resembling the World War II price controls will become a serious policy contender in the United States. But that doesn't mean that the calls for price controls can be ignored. They are a symptom of deep discontent with our economic and political system and its approach to price stabilization. High inflation in 2021 and 2022 did not, by itself, cause this discontent, but it did make it more apparent. Public trust in the Federal Reserve began to decline, and calls for other forms of state intervention in prices abounded. Because I am an economist who studies inflation, central banking, and economic history, I have followed these developments closely as they unfolded, and I have become convinced that understanding our current inflation environment requires much more than just economic analysis. As a society, our approach to inflation and price stabilization is closely tied to our approach to democracy, and both of these approaches have changed over time. I wrote this book to provide an account of how price fluctuations and attempts to manage them through price controls, monetary policy, tariff policy, and other means have shaped American democracy since its very beginning. By price fluctuations, I mean movements in both aggregate and particular prices. For much of U.S. history, especially before aggregate inflation statistics were readily available, certain prices, like land prices, crop prices, and energy prices, have been especially consequential. The book proceeds chronologically from the colonial era to the present, tracing the evolution of beliefs about price fluctuations and the role of the state in American democracy. It is not just an economic or monetary history, but also a history of thought, synthesizing views from legal scholars and the courts, economists, political scientists, politicians, and the popular press. I do provide policy recommendations in the last chapter, but more than I hope to convince anyone of my recommendations, I hope to equip listeners with and without formal economics training to think more deeply about what alternative approaches to price stabilization might mean, not just for the economy, but for the social and political system. The history of American democracy can be viewed through the lens of many different tensions between liberty and security, between agriculture and industry, between Wall Street and Main Street, and between populism and liberalism, among others. As this book shows, these tensions have shaped the struggle to find a legitimate role for the state in managing and stabilizing prices. This is one of the defining struggles of American democracy, and it is a continuing struggle. The former central banker Paul Tucker, no known relation to Todd, uses the term legitimacy to mean that the public, society as a whole, accepts the authority of institutions of the state, including independent agencies and their right to deploy the state's powers. Legitimacy grounds and comprises the capacity of an agency to pursue its mandate as part of the broader state apparatus without relying wholly on coercive power. Tucker's reference to coercive power is crucial for understanding the debates about legitimacy as it relates to prices. In a free market, the price mechanism coordinates economic exchange without the need for coercion. Interference in free markets at least implicitly relies on the coercive power of the state. The founders were aware of this and highly skeptical of allowing coercive power to lead to tyranny. For example, the Reverend John Witherspoon, a member of the Continental Congress, argued that the price controls that state and local governments imposed during the Revolutionary War were illegitimate because they forced or coerced a seller to sell his wares at a price to which he did not consent. Tucker's definition of legitimacy also makes it clear that legitimacy, insofar as it depends on public acceptance, is a dynamic and contestable concept, because public values and beliefs vary over time and across people. We can see this in the evolution of beliefs about not only price controls, but also monetary policy. Changing public priorities, jurisprudence, power structures, and economic theories have shifted the feasible set of approaches to price stabilization over the decades. Recurrent themes in American democracy and price stability. Several key themes emerge in this exploration of price stabilization in American democracy. The disparate impacts of price fluctuations. An important theme of this book is that price fluctuations affect different interest groups in different ways. The early United States was largely a nation of farmers. For some of the founders, like Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, the self-sufficient small farmer was the economic and social foundation of democracy. By the time of the Constitutional Convention, the founders had already seen how fluctuations in land prices and crop prices could increase and then wipe out the prosperity of a large segment of the population. Debates about the new nation's monetary and banking institutions reflected the concern that price fluctuations could exacerbate tensions between agrarian and industrial interests. Deflation is especially hard on farmers because they tend to be debtors. Inflation erodes the real, inflation-adjusted, value of debt, benefiting creditors at the expense of debtors. Deflation does just the opposite. If farmers have taken on debt to purchase land or seeds, and prices subsequently fall, it will be more costly than they anticipated to pay back the debt. If the price of the particular crop that they sell falls, perhaps due to declining global demand or a bumper crop abroad, their plight will be even worse. Throughout American history, farmers and their advocates have pushed for a variety of different policies to address the ill effects of price fluctuations. One such policy is a tariff, intended to protect farmers from low prices of foreign competitors. It is important to recognize, however, that farmers have not universally embraced tariffs. Farmers in different regions of the country grow different types of crops and have different exposure to foreign markets. Some have opposed tariffs for fear of retaliatory tariffs that would hurt their export revenue. Thus, tariff debates have had a tendency to exacerbate not only tensions between agriculture and industry, but also regional tensions. They have also prompted disputes between producers and labor interests over whether wages have kept pace with tariff-induced price increases. Farm interests have also played a large role in the development of monetary policy. Jeffersonian and Jacksonian Democrats' skepticism of paper money came partly from a fear that paper money would contribute to price fluctuations that were so harmful to farmers. For Andrew Jackson, hard money was a way to protect the common man from the dangers of price fluctuations. But years of deflation in the late 19th century led to a shift in this view. The Democrats came to view gold not as the solution, but as the problem. Removing the shackles of gold, some thought, would allow the government to more actively promote farm interests through monetary expansion. Farm representatives spent decades advocating for an end to the gold standard and a more activist central bank before this finally came to pass. Even as the farming share of the population declined, a major challenge for politicians has been to reconcile farmers' demands for higher crop prices with consumers' demands for lower food prices. This has led to a recurrent tendency to blame food price inflation on, and to legitimize regulation of, profiteers, price gougers, and monopolists. Other examples of the disparate impacts of price fluctuations and their political consequences appear throughout the book. Contracting and due process. The first theme is closely related to the second, contracting and due process. Because inflation has different effects on debtors and creditors, and contracts are typically written in nominal terms, that is, not inflation-adjusted terms, the evolution of contract jurisprudence has played an important role in shaping the government's response to price fluctuations. The founders' discomfort with paper money came largely from the recognition that monetary depreciation and price inflation alter the value of debts that have been contracted, and from concern that government interference with contracts was unjust. The founders' regard for contracts is apparent in the Constitution. The contract clause in Article 1, Section 10 prohibits the states from passing any law impairing the obligation of contracts. This clause and the related due process clauses of the 5th and 14th Amendment have been central to the court's interpretations about when, whether, and how the government can conduct monetary policy and regulate prices. The 5th Amendment, which applies to the federal government, states that no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. And the 14th Amendment adds, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. The interpretation of these clauses has been contentious. Does a legal tender law impair contract obligations? Does a price ceiling deprive a producer of his or her property? In the Civil War, when government-issued legal tender paper money called greenbacks contributed to wartime inflation, major legal cases concerning greenbacks centered on contract obligations and due process. Later in the New Deal era and World War II, contracts and due process were again in the spotlight when President Roosevelt attempted first to reverse the deflation of the Great Depression and then to control prices during the war. These are just the most salient of many examples throughout the chapters of this book. The concern that price fluctuations interfere with contracting has also been used as motivation for a more active state role in price stabilization. The economist Irving Fisher, one of the central characters of this book, argued that with either inflation and deflation, incalculable injustice would be wrought. One of the parties to every contract would be swindled for the benefit of the other, and the swindle would affect the fortunes for good or ill of almost every family in the land. This motivated his decades-long campaign for the central bank to adopt a price stabilization mandate, which he framed as a social justice issue. Crisis and Leviathan. A third theme of this book is that wars, or emergencies more broadly defined, have a tendency to legitimize a more activist role of the state in the economic system. Of course, I am not the first to point this out. Notably, Crisis and Leviathan is the title of Robert Higgs' 1987 history of the federal government's widening authority of over economic decision-making in response to national emergencies. Higgs describes a ratchet effect of government growth, in which the expanded scale and scope of government activities in a crisis fails to fully recede after the crisis. The history of price stabilization in America provides many examples that support Higgs' thesis. Most of the major inflationary episodes in U.S. history have been associated with wars, which require large increases in military spending. To finance these expenditures, the government has often resorted to monetary policies that would not have been considered acceptable outside of wartime. For example, I have referred already to the greenbacks in the Civil War. Political and legal debates about the greenbacks, as I noted, focused on contract impairment and due process. But they also focused on the necessary and proper clause of Article 1, Section 8, which gives Congress the power to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the enumerated powers, including the power to declare war and raise and support an army and navy. During the Civil War, there was intense disagreement about whether the legal tender acts that authorized the greenbacks were necessary or proper. After the war, the Supreme Court first ruled the acts unconstitutional, then subsequently reversed its opinion. Eventually, the 1884 case Juilliard v. Greenman upheld the constitutionality of the legal tender acts, even outside of wartime, authorizing Congress to issue greenbacks in times of peace. The ratchet effect in action. In both world wars, efforts to address wartime inflation included price controls, especially on strategically important products like coal, steel, and wheat. These wartime experiences with controls had lasting impacts on public and political beliefs about the economic role of the state, even as the controls themselves were rolled back. The imposition of price controls required major expansions of administrative agencies, also with lasting effects. Numerous court challenges to emergency price controls have played an important role in shaping jurisprudence on economic rights and due process. Price controls, as I have mentioned in the discussion of the previous theme, have prompted much debate about the interpretation of the Constitution's due process clauses. Constitutional scholars disagree about the extent to which the due process clauses limit the government's actions in time of war, and the court's approach to this question has been inconsistent. Some aspects of wartime price control legislation have been ruled unconstitutional on due process grounds, but the court has also acknowledged that a public exigency will justify the legislature in restricting property rights to a certain extent without compensation. Price fluctuations and the government's responses to them have also had a tendency to shift the balance of power between the branches of government and between the federal government and the states, and this is especially true during times of emergency. In particular, the president's role as commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy carries with it very broad war powers, which have at times legitimized a larger role of the executive in economic affairs and restrictions on the jurisdiction of the federal courts. During World War II and the Korean War, the War Powers Acts of 1941 and 1942 and the Defense Production Act of 1950 gave the executive branch substantial authority over domestic industry, including powers to set prices and wages. Even non-war emergencies, like the Great Depression have expanded the role of the executive. For example, the Thomas Amendment of the Agricultural Adjustment Act of 1933 granted President Roosevelt unprecedented monetary powers to support his goal of reflating prices. More recently, the COVID-19 pandemic has been described as a global war, and both President Donald Trump and President Joe Biden invoked the Defense Production Act to respond to the emergency, for example, to prevent price gouging on designated items. The pandemic, like other wars, prompted major fiscal and monetary stimulus that contributed to rising inflation. Pandemic-related supply chain disruptions and the Russian war against Ukraine have also contributed. Together, these global emergencies have brought inflation and the government's role in price stabilization into the spotlight. The power of ideas and the long road to inflation targeting. A fourth thread of this book is the long road to inflation targeting in the United States. Typical accounts of inflation targeting begin in the late 20th century, when central banks around the world began formally adopting inflation targeting frameworks for monetary policy. The untold history of inflation targeting is much longer and highlights both the power of ideas and the complex interactions of economic theories, politics, and policy reform. Because today's inflation hawks tend to be conservative, it may also surprise listeners to learn that the earliest advocates of a price stabilization mandate for the Federal Reserve were progressive reformers in the farm lobby. Irving Fisher, as I mentioned, is a central character in this book. An academic, a public intellectual, and a progressive activist, Fisher spent decades pushing for the Federal Reserve to have a price stabilization mandate. He also spent decades promoting the eugenics movement. Luckily, that campaign bore less fruit. Fisher's work on price stabilization began even before the Fed existed, and he nearly convinced Congress to give the Fed a price stabilization mandate at its inception. Instead, the Federal Reserve Act of 1913 kept the United States on the gold standard. But throughout the 1920s and 1930s, he gained the ear of several congressmen who introduced bills that would have amended the Federal Reserve Act to make price stability the Fed's primary goal. These bills were considered quite radical because they implied a departure from the gold standard orthodoxy, in which the dollar was to be kept convertible to a fixed weight of gold. Instead, Fisher thought that the dollar's value in terms of gold should be allowed to fluctuate in order to stabilize the dollar's purchasing power. His own work on the development of price indexes would facilitate such a task. The price stabilization bills that Fisher championed tended to gain the support of farm interests who wanted to avoid the bouts of deflation that the gold standard sometimes produced. Although these price stabilization bills were not enacted, Fisher's ideas and lobbying had lasting influence. During the Great Depression, Fisher collaborated with the Committee for the Nation to Rebuild Prices and Purchasing Power, a pressure group that mobilized public opinion in support of dollar depreciation. When President Roosevelt did devalue the dollar and take the United States off the gold standard, Fisher declared his ideas vindicated. From there, the road to modern inflation target was a winding one and makes an excellent case study of how economic ideas make their way into public policy. And on the flip side, how other ideas do not. For example, nominal income targeting, which I discuss in the later chapters of this book, is another possible approach that central banks could have taken to stabilize prices and macroeconomic conditions. The inflation targeting thread of this book also highlights the difficulties in balancing technocratic discretion with democratic accountability. Under the gold standard, at least in theory, monetary policy followed a rule-based framework. policymakers were constrained by the requirement that the dollar be convertible to a fixed weight of gold. The end of the gold standard lifted this constraint, giving monetary policymakers more discretion to pursue objectives like price stability and
Sample complete. Ready to continue?